There's an ancient rabbinic proscription which prohibits the drinking of wine by Jews which has been grown or prepared by non-Jews. This rule goes back to ancient times when wine was a central element in many religious rites, when the priests would often go out to the fields and pronounce incantations over the vine, and when the actual act of treading the grape and turning it into wine was often a religious occasion. This rule goes under the heading of Chukot HaGoyim, the laws which are incumbent upon the Jew in order to keep him clear from even inadvertent forms of idolatry, so that he may not inadvertently, innocently, be performing or ingesting some ritual, some act which is a form of devotion to the gods. Now, if you understand this background, you will appreciate, I believe, the story which is reported of Samuel Adnon. When he returned to Israel 2 years ago after receiving the Nobel Prize in Literature, after a tour through the great literary capitals of Europe, a tour which was probably the first time for this quiet, simple man to be among the literary lions and the political great. And he was asked how he had enjoyed all of this adulation. And he answered, according to the report, in this way. Let me tell you a story. My wife has an uncle who was once traveling abroad, and he became ill. And he consulted a physician. The physician told to him that he ought to drink some wine. Now, my wife's uncle had only drank wine for a kiddush, and only then, of course, kosher wine. So he looked around the town where he was, and he could not find any kosher wine. What could he do? He went to the store and he bought some good red wine. We asked him about it when he came home, and he told us, you know, I never knew that wine could taste so good. Adnon is a storyteller. Storyteller in a world which enjoys the flat, prosaic, technical, scientific style. Adnon is essentially a very sweet man, a simple, uncomplicated man in a world which delights to expose the confusion and the ugliness which roils in the depths within. Adnon is a man of a past, of a particular past, a past which is particularly Jewish. And though, of course, in his literature he deals with the universal themes which affect all men, he does so with the imagery, with a symbolism, with a sense of history, out of the particular and peculiar history which has been that of the Jewish people in these last decades and centuries. And that's why he is particularly interesting to us. But it's not simply that an Israeli, a writer in Hebrew, has become one of the great literary figures of the age. That is good and to be expected of a literate people. It's not only that some have come to such a level of competence in Hebrew that they can write some of the best literature of the world. 50 years ago, Hebrew was a dead language, spoken only in the holiness of the sanctuary. Adnon is the first man in history to have received a Nobel laureate for writing in a language which was not the language of his cradle. But particularly, Adnon, for us as Jews, reveals to us the depths, the imagery, the frustrations, the feelings, the sensitivities which have coursed through Jewish life these past decades. Adnon has lived always within the Jewish world, not the Jewish world as we know it in this American diaspora, a world where Judaism is an occasional ritual in the home, an occasional hour in the synagogue, but a full-bodied, full-flown, full-blown Jewish world. He was born in Galicia in the 1880s. He was born into a small town in North Austria-Hungary where the majority of the people were Jews. Yiddish was his birth language. He was raised in a home with rabbinic scholarly traditions. His grandfather had been a fine rabbinic scholar. He was raised in a home where the library was filled with the books and the lore of our tradition, both rabbinic and Hasidic. By the time that he was 15, he was composing poems in both Yiddish and Hebrew, and he was acting as an assistant editor to one of the enlightened Hebrew presses, newspapers, which were beginning to be published throughout that part of the world. In 1907, he went to Jaffa, to Palestine, to the Yishuv. And he was part of the second Aliyah, the second group of Eastern European Jews who came in those decades to settle the land and to create there a Jewish state. He wrote in Hebrew, and he was part of the first settlement. The only time in his life that he lived at all the kind of life that we live, a life caught in suspension between two cultures, was between the years of 1913 and 1924, when he left Jaffa for Berlin, for Germany, and where he lived in the greatest, most intellectualized country of Europe for almost a decade. But even here, his life was peculiarly and particularly Jewish. It was lived among Jews. He was under a fellowship granted to him by Schocken, one of the great German Jewish publishers. He lived within the world of Jewish interests. He spent much of his time with Martin Buber compiling a great anthology of Hasidic legends and tales. Zionist interests, Jewish cultural interests, religious interests were part of his life. And though this man has always been aware of the larger world of literature and of thought, had been influenced by many of the contemporary non-Jewish authors. He returned in 1924 and lived in Palestine, in Israel, from that day to the day 3 weeks ago, when at the age of 82, full of years and full of accomplishment, he died. And so we have in Adnan a man who has breathed the atmosphere of Jewish life for 8 decades, a man who has lived through the shtetl in its fullness, in its warmth, the Eastern European Jewish community, which was parochial, which was homely, heimische, home. And he has seen the dissolution of that community, the pogroms and the persecution, the two world wars and Hitler, who has lived through the early years of settlement in the Holy Land and seen the confusion of purpose which disturbed those who came to settle. Why were they there? What were they seeking to accomplish? He lived through and was part of the renaissance of Jewish letters, the renaissance of Hebrew learning, which has happened in Israel these past 30 or 40 years. The Holocaust, redemption, Israel, all these have been the stuff of his life and the stuff from which he has woven his literature. But he's a particular kind of person. In a world in which most of us prize commitment and passion, the activist, Adnan has been the observer, the writer, the man who sought to understand, to empathize with, to put down on paper what he observed. His very name, Adnan, is interesting in this respect. It's a pen name. His real family name is Zaskus. He took the name of Adnan very early in his life because it symbolized to him his role. What was his role? That of the aguna. The aguna in Jewish life was the deserted woman. The woman in medieval times who was married, whose husband went on a journey to market for commerce, for scholarly reasons, and who simply disappeared. This was often the case in the ancient world. Travel was uncertain. Many men were captured and held for ransom or sold into slavery. Men disappeared for many years, sometimes forever. And Jewish life, which was terribly concerned with the sanctity of the home, which was concerned lest a woman feel that her husband had died, had disappeared, and was no longer, feared that she might remarry only to discover that her husband was still alive, that he, in fact, could and had returned, prohibited the remarriage of such a woman, the aguna, unless there was positive proof of her husband's death. And so the aguna sat, lonely, bereft, full of nostalgia, full of nightmare, uncertain of her future, neither wife nor widow, living obviously in the past and of the past, yet daring just to hope that there might be a future. And that's Adnan's role. He's lived as the observer. He's of the past. His love is to the traditions of the old world, the world from which he came, the cradle world of the shtetl. But he's very much a man of his world. He knows that this world has been stripped away from him, that it is no longer. And he awaits. He awaits its return. He awaits his first love. He's neither wife nor widow, but a keen, sensitive observer of all the passions, of all the feelings, of all the uncertainties of the exile, of the insecurity, the loneliness of modern man. How shall I tell you of Adnan? Let me tell you of Adnan as he might want it told through his own stories. They're woven of the stuff of Jewish life, and this particular story is woven of a familiar melody, a familiar hymn to God, which is sung in the synagogues and sung in the homes of Jews during the Purim. You know, Purim is that great masquerade in which we retell the legend of how the Jews of Persia were redeemed from the decree of genocide against them, the decree of extermination, which Haman had won from Ahasuerus. And even as we read the Megillah and try to drown out the name of Haman, the archetype, the prototype of all the enemies of Israel, of all those who have plotted for Israel's destruction, we sense the reality and the unreality, the half-truth, the full truth of the Purim story. There may not have been a Haman. There have been many Hamans. There may not have been that day of Purim deliverance, but somehow there have been many moments in which, despite ourselves, despite our fears, Israel has redeemed, been redeemed. Israel has survived. And after we read the Megillah, a quiet falls in the synagogue or in the home, and this melody is heard. Shoshanat Yaakov, Sahala Smecha. Birotam Yachad Techelet Mordechai. Shoshanat Yaakov, the lily of Jacob, rejoices and is delighted because together they see Mordechai clothed in purple, clothed in royal approval. Shoshanat Yaakov, the lily of Jacob. An interesting juxtaposition of nouns. Jacob, the patriarch. Jacob, who wrestled the long night with his conscience, with the angel of God, who could not prevail of him. Jacob, who won for himself the name Israel. Shoshana, the lily, the white flower of purity, the white flower which in our tradition symbolizes loyalty and constancy, devotion to the tradition. The lily which symbolizes in our tradition the Torah, the tradition itself. Shoshanat Yaakov, the devoted of Israel, rejoice and delight that together, as together they see Mordechai, the Jew, delivered, free, himself. Shoshana B'Yaakov, Susanna and Jacob. About 25 years ago, Adnan wrote a story which was called The Betrothal Oath, Shavuot Emunim. It's an interesting story as you read it the first time, a story of love, a rather macabre, gothic story of love between two young people who were raised together as children in a bourgeois setting in Austria-Hungary before the First World War. And one is Shoshana, and one is Yaakov. Shoshana is the delightful little girl, Yaakov, a very bright, precocious young man. And these two children play together, and as children will, at one point, they make an oath of perpetual love. Each takes a lock of his hair, her hair, and cuts it off. The locks are mingled together, and they burn the locks. And then each one takes of the mingled dust and touches it to his lips and makes the promise, Erastich li lo'olam, I will betroth thee unto me forever. But such is the way of the world that children go where their parents go, and the lives of these two children are separated. Susanna Shoshana continues to live with her parents the life of upper middle class bourgeois in Austria-Hungary, a comfortable, sedate, secure life. Jacob's family has a turn for worse in their fortune. They move away. And Jacob begins the long, hard climb of the young Jewish man through the gymnasium, through the university, to his doctorate, to his professional skill. He becomes a biologist, and particularly a marine biologist. And as is the way of the world, once he has his doctorate, his degree, he goes out into the wide world to make his fame and his fortune, and as chance would have it, he comes to Palestine, he comes to Jaffa, where the seacoast is particularly rich with marine life. And he settles down there as an instructor in the local gymnasium. He settles down there to the collection and to the classification of the marine life, particularly the seaweed, which grows off the Palestinian coast. In the meantime, Shoshana's mother dies, and she and her father begin a wandering around the world looking for, we're not sure what, finding, tiredness, some sights, some experience, we're not sure what. In Jaffa, in the meantime, Jacob is leading a rather quiet, comfortable life. He has many friends among the settlers in this city, particularly those from Austria-Hungary and Germany and Czechoslovakia, those who have some culture. He meets many of their young daughters. Each has her own allurements and her own charms. He cannot choose between the various girls whom he meets. And because he cannot choose, and because there is no intensity to his relationship with any, he and these six particular young ladies form a little club. They delight to be together, and together they walk at night along the coast of Jaffa, talking of many things, of life, of future, and of the world. And then Shoshana and her father come in their world, traveling to Jaffa. After all, Palestine too must be seen. And when Jacob sees Susanna, Shoshana again, he feels deep within him a sudden tug. He sees the pull of childhood is on him. He feels though he wants to express some feeling, some love. He's not sure what emotion. And she is quiet and withdrawn. He senses that she feels something too, but he's not quite sure what she is feeling. And they pass each other and eat meals with each other. And in time, they find themselves one afternoon in the garden. And finally, Shoshana breaks her silence and she says to Jacob, "Do you remember the vow?" "I do." "Do you remember every word of the vow?" "I do." "Are we still burdened by the vow?" And Jacob doesn't know what to answer. What shall he say? You have a sense that whatever he says is critically important in his life. And then without thinking, without knowing what he's going to say, his mouth says, "I am. I am burdened, obliged by the vow." And they pass. And each goes his own way, but something has passed between them. They have come closer again, something of the closeness of their childhood. Jacob goes back to his studies. Susanna, her father, go to travel throughout the land. She becomes more and more withdrawn, more and more uncertain. And finally, she falls into a sleep, a deep sleep, and the doctors pronounce that she has a sleeping sickness. What is Jacob to do? Shall he tell with counsel her father of his love for her? Shall he remain constantly by her side? A letter has come from New York telling of a fine appointment at a great American university. The offer is made. Shall he accept it? Shall he stay? Shall he remain? Which world is to be his? Little happens. Time passes. The sleeping beauty sleeps. Jacob is torn between his work, his love, his uncertainty, his feelings. There is work to be completed. And as he completes the work of classification, the six girls whom he has been friendly with suddenly appear. And they invite him, they entice him down once more to the shore. And as they walk happily along, somehow they decide upon a race, these six girls. They will race along the shore to a point far beyond and return. And Jacob shall make for the victor a ring of seaweed, a laurel out of the seaweed with which he has worked, his gift of love, and somehow it is no longer a game. She who wins the race will have Jacob's heart in Jacob's hand. And off these six girls go. And though nothing has been said, one senses the portentousness of the race. And Jacob is standing there with the wreath, the winner's wreath in his hand. and he closes his eyes, is he awake, is he asleep, what is reality? And one is not sure in the story whether he opens his eyes again or he sees with his inner eye, but suddenly there is a seventh girl running in the race, and she is outdistancing them all. And the seventh girl is Shoshana. Shoshana comes, and she wins the race, and without saying a word, she takes the wreath of seaweed from Jacob's hand, and she places it upon her head. And there we leave now the story of Jacob and Susanna. And that's the way that Agnon ends his story. Now, what have we here? We have, in the first instance, an imaginative, symbolic, mysterious love story. Kafka could have written it, or Isaac Babel. A story which tells of young love and of separation and of the confusions of young people before the ultimate decision. What have we here? We have a story woven of some of the oldest folk images of the race. The story of the race for the golden apple, for who shall get the hand of the princess. The story of the Sleeping Beauty. What have we here? We have a story of Shoshanat Yaakov, a story of Shoshana, the tradition, the loyal, Jacob, Israel. Or have we not here somehow deep within this love tale, a story of Israel today, of us, of young men and young women who have set out to conquer the secular world, who have sensed its possibilities, its wholesomeness, who have found our degrees, who have earned our degrees, who have made our way, who find ourselves surrounded by the lovely young things, the young philosophies of the day, and we cannot make up our mind between them. But somehow, despite it all, the love of our youth, the faith of the cradle, comes back to us and pulls us back to her. And somehow, in the real world, or is it only in the imaginary world? We are drawn together. But there's more, I think, to this story. Herzl, the great founder of political Zionism, wrote an imaginative utopian novel called Altneuland, Old New Land. In this novel, he described what he thought Palestine would be like when it became a Jewish state. And he describes there a Palestine which is the very, very model of a modern secular society. Righteous, technically proficient, scientifically efficient. But there is nothing that is Jewish in this state. Hebrew is not the national language. There is no concern for a Hebrew university. There is concern only for the technical and the scientific and the humane values of Western civilization. And I wonder if we don't have, if we do not have in this story, Agnon's awareness that Herzl's vision could not be fulfilled because deep down within the soul of even the most secular Jew of our age, there is the attachment, the feeling, the love for the faith, for Shoshana, the child of our youth. So that even those who come to Israel not to create a Jewish state, but to fulfill their own professional destiny, even they are somehow drawn back to the tradition, drawn back into the world from which we once all came. But what of Shoshana? What of the tradition, which is a Sleeping Beauty? What of the tradition which was such a lovely child in the exile over there in Europe? With a child which in Israel falls asleep, falls away from reality. Is this not in part true of Judaism in Europe and in Israel? It fit its time, it fit the shtetl, but does it fit? Did it fit in the same form, intimately, easily, into the life of a pioneering society? Must not ultimately Judaism break loose, come awake, outdistance the other girls, the other philosophies, those other ideas which are blandishments to the young, if it wishes to claim Jacob, to claim us back for its own? A The story of Agnon operates on many levels. It appeals to the mind, it appeals to the heart, it appeals to the aesthetic sense. It is always imaginative and always symbolic and always many-sided. And that is its beauty. He's a craftsman, a serious artist, not one who simply slapdashes words down upon the paper in order to finish as many books as he can and earn as many dollars as he can within a given year. He's a man who is concerned with values, a very rare phenomenon among writers in the 20th century. Most writers are concerned with people and the clash of personalities or with labeling the pathologies of the human mind and heart. But Agnon is concerned with values, with philosophies, with loyalties, with human goals. And he stands between two worlds, between a past which was whole and which was healing, which has been ruptured and is no more, and a future which has not yet been formed, where there is no certainty, a present where there is only doubt and loneliness and the sense of exile and confusion. And one finds Agnon coming back to the past and to the present again and again in all the serious writings, the major writings which he has edited. He comes back to the moments of his life which are in a sense the stages of Jewish life as we've lived it these last 50 or 80 years. One of his first great novels is called Hachnasat Kalah, The Bridal Canopy. It's an evocation, a romanticization, if you will, of the ghetto, of the shtetl, of the tight, warm Hasidic communities of Eastern Europe. It's a story of Reb Yudel, a Jewish drayman, a simple Jew who has three daughters, who sets out to find first the money and then the husband for his daughters. And as he wanders through Poland and Carpathia and Galicia, he meets all the various familiar types of Sholem Aleichem, of the fiddler on the roof, all the kinds of people who were once part of this populist, ordinary, rich folk culture, which our people had in Eastern Europe. They're not all saints, but they're all human. They're not all decent, but they're all full-bodied and full-blown. Hachnasat Kalah is our sense of the past which has been lost. And then there's another great novel which is of the past which cannot be recovered. You can't go home again. It's called The Lodger or the Guest that Dwells or that Tarries for the Night, Oreach Lalun Laila. It's set in the mid-1920s. It's a story of a visit by one who has lived this life in Eastern Poland back to the village of his birth in order to find there the great scholarship, the love, the sense of intimacy which was once so precious to him. What does he find? A village in disarray, a synagogue that is closed, a school which has no more pupils, young people who are emigrating, older people who are living only in the past, a community which has never been able to pull itself together after the trauma of the pogrom and of the First World War, a community which has been left behind and knows that its end is near, that it's only a matter of time. But interestingly, he will not leave it there. And he harks back to an old Midrashic legend which says that at the time of the Messiah, those synagogues, those schools which are still extant, will roll down the byways of the world to the land of Israel, where each will be planted in its place, and each will be filled with those that come from its birthplace. And so this guest who returns to Eastern Europe takes with him a key to the old Beit HaMidrash, the old school. He takes it back with him to Israel so that when his school comes, when the old is planted firmly in the new, then he will have the key to open the door, to return the past, to return from the present into the past, to bind the two worlds at one. His third great novel is called Tmol Shelshon. It's a story of, again, of Jaffa and Jerusalem in the days of the 1910s during the first great wave of Jewish settlement in Palestine. It's a story of the confusions of this settlement. It's the story of a young man named Kumar, the one who comes to Jaffa, who sets out to work the land, but who finds, as so many of the pioneers did, that the sweat and the tears and the anguish of the pioneer is too much a demand to be put upon him. And so he goes to the city, and he becomes a house painter. But he finds it totally unsatisfying to be splashing new paint on old walls. He wants something more. He goes to Jerusalem. He marries the daughter of one of the most orthodox in the Mea Shearim, in the old center of Jerusalem, where those who wailed for the return of Messiah, the most pious, the most orthodox, lived. And he lives this life. He throws himself into the past, but he must walk out of the Mea Shearim to do his shopping, to meet people, to be with others. He cannot live simply within the walls of what has been. One day, in his frustration and his desperation, he meets a dog on the street. He begins to taunt the dog, and the dog becomes maddened and bites him, and he dies. An odd, strange, nightmare ending. But not quite. For the dog has a name. The dog's name is Balak. You remember from our Bible how when the children of Israel left Egypt, when they were wandering in the wilderness, when they came close to the promised land, one of the kings of Transjordan, Balak, hired a prophet, Balaam, to come and curse Israel, that their way may not prosper, that their path should not succeed. Balak is the enemy. Balak are those who wish this people ill, who can be maddened, as the Turk was maddened, as the Arab was maddened, as in time the British were maddened, and who were unwilling to allow the natural settlement of a Jewish home. But Balak is more. Balak is the man who hired the prophet to curse the Jew, but the prophet could not curse the Jew. The prophet went up upon the mountainside, Balaam, and he looked down upon the camp of Israel, and he opened his mouth to utter the curse, and he said instead, Matovu ohalecha Yaakov, mishkenotecha Yisrael, how goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, thy dwelling places of Israel. God put other words in his mouth. Despite himself, he was forced to speak well and hopefully of Israel. Balak is then the enemy, but the enemy who hires the friend, the enemy who hires the one who blesses. Out of opposition, somehow would come the sinews, the infrastructure, the political structure of the Jewish state. And it worked out that way, did it not? Because of the adamancy of the British, there was created the Haganah, because we had to create within, underground, a Jewish state. One was ready for existence when the world proclaimed the Jewish state in 1948. Now, I'm told that before he died, Agnon was putting the last touches on a fourth great novel, which had to do with life in Israel, in Jerusalem today. I have not seen it. I know nothing except the bare fact of his existence. We await it eagerly, because somehow, in his own inimitable, symbolic, imaginative way, what he will say in this novel about modern Israel will tell us a great deal about its feelings, its depth, its worries, its anxieties, and its hopes. Agnon. The lonely one, the one who feels with apart yet withdrawn, the one who hardly dares to hope. These are some of the essential requirements of a writer, a man who will describe for you, give you the inner history of a people, searching to understand itself, searching to fulfill its destiny. I close with a story. One of Agnon's, of course. The story of a tailor named Israel. The story of a lord who had a great fine bolt of cloth, who summoned the tailor Israel to his palace and who said, make me a beautiful garment. Yes, my lord, make it within a day. Yes, my lord. And the tailor takes the bolt to his shop. He sits down to work on the cloth, but he's hungry. His wife distracts him. He becomes busy with the things with which all men become busy. And by day's end, the cloth is still a bolt, and there is no garment. The next morning, he is summoned to the palace. Where is my garment? I haven't finished it, my lord. Well, I forgive you this time, but by nightfall, my garment must be completed. Full of fear and trembling, the tailor Israel returns home. He sets to work in his shop, but he needs a drink. He needs some wine, something to give him courage to go on. He takes the wine, he lifts the cup to his lips, and the wine spills all over the cloth. What can he do? He takes the cloth to the seashore. He's going to wash it, to try and clean it. He puts the cloth down on the rock near the seashore. He turns to get his soap and his brush. He's hardly turned his back when a great fish leaps out of the sea, grabs the cloth, and drags it out into the depth. And the tailor, without thinking, rushes out after his cloth, after the fish. The fish goes farther and farther out to sea. The tailor swims more desperately after the fish. His feet become leaden. His hands become tired. He sinks. And he drowns. Israel is the tailor. A Lord Adonai. The Hebrew word Adonai means both Lord and Master and Lord God. The bolt of cloth, life, possibility. We cut our own cloth. We make our own garment. We're so busy doing the things with which we are busy that we do not meet the deadline. Time fleets by. We are summoned on Yom Kippur. We are summoned to make it count. We are forgiven. We are given another day, another chance. We fear, we tremble, it's late now. We spoil the cloth. We die. And this is the way Agnon ends this story. It is true, he writes, that the Holy One is merciful. But his servants, the angels of destruction, are hard and bitter and cruel, in heaven as on earth. As for the garment that the tailor did not complete, but rather dirtied and lost, we should note that the Lord had many garments and could have foregone one garment. But the tailor who lost the garment made of the cloth from the Lord's workshop, what can he answer when they ask him, where is the garment? What do we answer? Agnon can answer, here is my garment. Here is the gift of my soul and my skill. A library of books. A library of my understanding of people, my world, my people, these past years. Perhaps some will browse and read and find themselves in my writing or find encouragement or meaning in what I have to say. That is my garment. Where is yours? Amen.